Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. It's the new year. This is it. Is it happy? Has it worn off? Are you, where are you at? Does it feel different? Do we feel different? What did you do on New Year's? I mean, really, what did you do? One thing I don't do is stand-up comedy on New Year's. I learned that a long time ago. Unless they're paying you $1 million, what is the fucking point of performing on that night? Especially if you got to bring in the new year. Nothing but a nightmare. I don't recommend it for anyone. But I don't have to. It's easy for me to say. But that was one lesson I learned. Why perform on that night? I don't even know if it's expectations. The one thing you can expect on New Year's is that people are going to act like fucking idiots. They're going to get shit-faced. They're going to make a lot of noise no matter what. The world could be on fire, which it kind of is. And that night, people would just be like, woo, yeah, Happy New Year for that hour, for that 5 minutes, whatever it is leading up to it. But man, what a clusterfuck. What a nightmare. And then just a drive to the club to, you know, hopefully not get plowed into by some drunken idiot not paying attention or texting his buddy, getting directions to the next party so they're in the right place when the clock chimes midnight. That was always the panic. Where are we going to be for New Year's? Where do you want to be for New Year's? Which party you want to be at? Scrambling around, making it just under the wire to a mediocre party, looking around, 10, 9, is there anybody I like here? 8, 7, God damn it. Why did we come to this one? 6, 5, 4, oh, fuck, I don't know anybody here. 3, 2, God damn it. Why is that guy just fucking stepped on my foot and fucked up my new shoes? Happy New Year! Point is, I don't go out. I don't go do comedy. I stay off the roads. I was asleep by 11 with Sarah the painter. And I don't mind. I woke up and it was the new year and I didn't feel like I missed anything. I got up and I was like, well, this is it. We're in it. It's happening. What did we miss last night? Not a fucking thing. Zero. We didn't get to watch, you know, mid-level celebrities get shit-faced on television while a bunch of people froze their balls off in Times Square waiting for a thing to drop. And I see, now I sound cynical. I hope you had a good new year. I hope it was fun. I hope you brought it in the right way. I hope you got your shit and your mind straight. Today on the show, Seth MacFarlane is here, the creator of Family Guy, his new show, The Orville. He's directed and written movies. He's hosted the Oscars. He's a song and dance man. He's a crooner, jack of all trades, somewhat controversial, extremely talented. And I just wanted to talk to him. And I got the opportunity to do that. So Seth MacFarlane is on the show today. Also, my friend Christina Pazitsky, Christina P, just texted me. She's on a thing on Netflix now, a special called The Degenerates, which is a bunch of comics. She's the sixth one out of the gate. Very funny. Love Christina. She wanted me to mention that. And I said I would mention that. So The Degenerates, which is on Netflix, enjoy. As I said on Monday, I've begun the disengagement from social media platforms. I deleted my Facebook page, not the fan page. You can still go to that. I don't have much to do with that. That's where I post the episodes and whatnot. But my personal page, which I no longer really went to at all, but I did push delete, and it's gone. And I feel good. I don't feel as liberated as I would if I completely just dissolved my Twitter, which I'm processing. The problem with me is there's many. But the main problem with me and that stuff is that I don't have the wiring. I don't have the organic personal boundary technology within my machine that enables me to not be affected on some level by garbage and bullshit dumped into my Twitter feed. And I'd like to be over it. I'd like to be able to just roll with it, but maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I don't need to be numb that way. Maybe that's it. I'm going to try to figure out what we do with real time. Time. Just time away from that engagement with the speed of technology just pummeling our brains all the time. This is what I've been thinking about. This is some of the stuff I want to do in New Year's. Spend more time with human beings. Spend more time with my own thoughts. Process things at a regular pace, not at the pace demanded of me by how fast it comes in through my phone or my computer. Think about shit at my own speed. I don't even know if my brain can do that anymore. Yeah, my life is good. Things are okay. But do I have any friends? Where have all my friends gone? Have I talked to anybody recently? Is texting talking? Is seeing somebody on Twitter, knowing what they're up to, is that talking? Have I sat down with people? I swear to God, most of my social life outside of my very personal life, which only has a couple people in it, is in here talking to guests. And I'm looking at my phone at my friends. And out of all of them, I texted Dave Cross. I'm like, dude, how's it going? It's a new year. I'd like to see you sometime. If you're ever out here, love, Mark. And then he said, boy, you're such a sucker for the holidays. Yes. Don't know when I'm there next, but let's get Tex-Mex. And I said, okay, pal, not a sucker. Those of us with no wives or children given too much time just sit around and look at domestic animals and wonder if we actually have any friends anymore. By those of us, I mean me. Hope you're well. And then I thought about that for a few minutes. And before he texted back, I texted, I am good. Looking at that text could appear suicidal. Not the case, just saying hi. He said, I hear you. I'll hit you up next time I'm out and bore you to tears with cliches about having a kid at age 54. And then he wrote thumbs up emoji. And then I wrote panicky gritted teeth emoji. And he wrote, that's known as a Marin. And I wrote, ha. So now that was me, talking to my old friend, but that might be all I talked to him for maybe 6 months to a year. And I just started thinking, and this is part of the resolution thing, where are they? Who are they? And then it takes effort. I got to start inviting people over for dinner. I want to get back to, flesh and blood relationships with human beings. And you got to plan that stuff. Not these one-offs, not these very emotionally cathartic connected one-offs here in the garage. And also, look, the other thing about social media is that I'm just sitting on there. I'm not doing anything. You can see that I'm barely tweeting. And people are like, you have a comment on this? How about this? Look, the guy from Counting Crows and you look exactly like each other to some people. Are you the same person? Care to comment? No, I don't. I don't care. I don't want to comment. No, okay, that was someone's clever idea. Fine, but have fun with it. What do you need me to? What do you need my input? Of course we're not the same guy. What's going on? What do you think about, Louis? What about Louis C.K.? I don't care. I have not talked to the guy since that New York Times article. I don't know what he's up to. It seems like he's full of anger and survival. Survival mechanism has kicked in. That's my take. I don't know his life. It doesn't seem good. But it's not my fucking responsibility to comment on fucking everything that happens in the world on Twitter. I'm talking like that someone, I'm talking as if someone is attacking me right now. See what it does to me? Do you see what it does to me? Yeah. I don't know about that friend thing. I guess that's really what it is. Everybody goes and they do their own life. But when you make the choices I've made, and that's to live alone, not have a wife, not have children. Cats, you kind of hit a wall with cats. I love them. I know them. They're good to have around. But They don't, you know, there's not a lot of deep conversing going on, and there's not a lot of change in the conversation with cats. But, you know, I'm happy they're around. Here's a cat-related email. You healed our cat, Mark. Thank you. The other day, our boy wasn't in the driveway when we pulled up. He's an outdoor cat, but he's always there waiting for us when we pull into the driveway 100% of the time. So we knew something was wrong when he wasn't there. About 15 minutes after we parked and went in the house, we heard him meow. We opened the door and felt so relieved to see him, but he was limping so badly. We were just trying to decide whether to take him to the vet immediately or in a couple of days. His collar was also gone. Scary moment. What happened to the kitty? The next day we took him in, we had to wait in the room for 2 hours to be seen. He's a stoic little guy, but after an hour of waiting for anything, especially while in pain, anybody would get restless, cat or human. He began shaking and shifting his body every 10 or 15 seconds, so I decided to throw on WTF in the background to give us something to focus on. It was the latest episode, your interview with Ronaldo Marcus Green. Great convo, just great. But the monologue was the standout. Our cat Julius immediately lied down, calmed down, and started meditating with his eyes rolled back. All three of us listened intently as you began reviewing movies, made your New Year's resolution to shut off your connection to social media and become more grounded into your purpose and to spend more time with the people you love. In particular, your review of the Indian pottery documentary left us so chilled out and relaxed. That review was, dare I say, spiritual, but in an everyday people kind of way. We will definitely check that film out. Just your review of it made our cat purr. So even before the vet came in to see him, you had already healed him. Thank you, Mark. You're an inspiring dude on multiple levels. We're waiting to see if our little guy's leg is broken. But while we wait, I figured I'd write to say thank you to your twice-a-week service. You give a sense of home to so many people and cats. By the way, our little boy is named Julius because, you guessed it, he's orange. With much respect and appreciation, Brian. Glad to help out. Yeah, see, like you people who fast forward through this, you're missing the spiritual value of my rambling intros. You're missing it. You're missing the spiritual value. There was another one. Subject line, to kill the loneliness. Hey, Mark, my name is Brooks. I am a 20-year-old. In June, my first love broke my heart where I lost 15 pounds during the heartbreak. I found your show, Marin. It helped me, made me laugh and feel better. I also work at a grocery where at times I have to work in a one-man kiosk gas station where I have to stand alone and wait for people to come to the window. WTF helps kill the loneliness, and the interviews fill the white wall kiosk. Thank you for the laughter during my first real heartbreak. Happy New Year, Brooks. I'm a loneliness killer. Man, that is a service. I'm going to put that on my business card. Mark Maron, loneliness killer. WTF, loneliness killer. Dig it. Yeah, so I'm watching shit. Somehow or another, there's some weird old Sam Kennison set on Netflix. It's a disaster. It's a Las Vegas set a year or so before he died. And that kind of got me watching the original HBO special, which I hadn't seen in years. Now, this is a guy, if some of you know my story, and this has been sitting with me for a while because I did a interview for a documentary about the Comedy Store that Mike Binder is directing. And he asked me to talk about my experience there. And a lot of it had to do with that guy. And my sort of my position has always been that he doesn't, you know, really get the respect he should as one of the great comics. And Mike was like, I don't know if he was that great. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, he had this momentum. He had this pace, this intensity. He really owned the stage like nobody had ever seen before. He had this fury and this like force, this kind of like, just, you know, the air changed when the guy went on. I'd never seen anybody really do that. And Mike was like, yeah, but I don't know. I think it was the time. I think if you really look at that material, it might just be those bits. I mean, anyone could have good bits. So I just don't think he was that great. And I, you know, it just stuck with me. And this is a couple months ago that we had this conversation. I watched the HBO special, half of it, and I watched that Vegas thing, and I was like, God damn it, he was not a right-minded dude, man. He was not a righteous cat, and I don't know how I got so sucked into that looking back on it. Could have been the coke. It could have been the excitement of the time, the late 80s, or just the sheer brute force of that guy's personality and that guy's charisma sucked me in. The brute force of charisma. Charisma with a punch. That's why we're where we're at with the, politically. You've got to watch your brain, man. You get sucker punched by some forceful, wrong-minded charisma, and you get all lit up. Got to watch that. So I've reassessed it, and I do not think he was as good as I thought he was. But stylistically, there was nothing like it. And I think that was the primary lesson there. How do you own the stage? I think that was really more of what I was learning. I also watched a little Hicks. I just flipping around the comedy. There's a lot of new comedies that were dumped onto Netflix, old comedy specials. Watched a little of the Hicks stuff from the Vic, where I did a special. It's always good to see Bill bouncing around. Yeah, sleep tight. So Seth MacFarlane is here, and I've never met him. I've seen some of his stuff. I've always wondered about him, and he's got this the second season of this space show that he's got. The Orville is on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on Fox. I think Fox is, by and large, the Seth MacFarlane station. Outside of the propaganda operation, the rest of it, I think, is Seth MacFarlane. But I was excited to talk to him, and this is me talking to Seth here in the garage.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
It's weird where my research takes me because I'm looking up Kent, where you come from.
Yeah,
because I have I've had things happen to me in Connecticut.
Really?
That's a
vague kind of dark thing. Is everything all right?
Yeah. No, when I started, not too traumatic, but when I started my comedy career, it was one-nighters, and there were ones there was one in New London. Mm-hmm. You'd go to drive to a bar in New London, and there was a, I saw a guy that I was opening for lose his mind on stage.
Really?
It was great.
Oh, I bet that was something to see.
It was just one of these things where, you drive for 2 hours from Boston. I was living in Boston, and you'd be taking a headliner who you didn't really know.
Yeah.
And this guy, Bob Batch, the whole way down, he's going I don't know why I can't get on fucking Letterman. Why can't I get on fucking Letterman for 2 hours?
That's his act.
No, this is in the car.
This is in the car. Okay.
But that's what happens. We get to this shitty fucking bar by the sub base. There's nine people in there. And I go on and do my half hour, and he just gets up, and within minutes, he's like, why can't I be on fucking Letterman? And he's yelling at the people.
Oh, God.
And it's uncomfortable. And for the first time in my life, and I was younger, I went into the middle of the room because there were so few people there. I go, let's just take a break. Bob, just relax a minute.
That's like finding a four-leaf clover when you catch a stand-up who's angry with the audience.
It's the best. It doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't.
Because they're afraid, they're afraid of the phones.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, in Boston, I'd see guys snap all the time. There were guys that you could sort of count on it.
Yeah, Chappelle makes his audience put their phones in steel cases or something before he does a show? Is that right?
Some clubs have bags now. The club in Denver has these bags.
You have to. It's like part of me hears these stories and just thinks, you know what, America, you don't deserve comedy anymore.
Yeah.
No more comedy for you. Because this is how the acts are honed. That's how you know where the line is.
They don't understand it.
They don't get it.
And I don't understand. They don't gain anything by putting the thing up. No. Fortunately, I'm at a level of celebrity where no one has tried to tape me or put my shit up. Yeah, there's been times where I'm like, could one of you tape this? Because I'd like to remember what I did. Yeah. But no.
But they need to have it explained to them. Look, you get to the point where you go to an arena with thousands of people and you're seeing a honed, polished stand-up act. You don't get to that point unless that act is right. tested and retested, and some of the jokes work and some of them don't.
And goes
some,
period.
Some of them are offensive.
Yeah.
You pull those jokes out, but you have to, the only way you know is by testing it in front of an audience.
You pull them out only if you can't shoulder the possible reaction.
Yes. Exactly.
There's a lot of gauging that has
but
to go on.
But they don't get it. They don't get it. And the press doesn't even get it.
No, I don't think anyone.
And they should.
I'm surprised how little people understand about anything. Like during the writer strike, it was sort of amazing to me that most, you know, somewhat intelligent people were like, oh, they don't just make it up. You know, yeah. Yeah. You mean John Stewart's not making it up every day?
The one I like is, now does each writer write for an individual character? Like, yes, I write all the Stewie lines. He writes all the Peter lines.
And he can't do anything else.
No.
That's all he does.
And we have to hope that it all comes together in a cohesive fashion.
Well, the other thing about Connecticut, I went to the P.T. Barnum Museum in Bridgeport and had a very uncomfortable...
It's a beautiful town, Bridgeport.
Yeah, uncomfortable moment at the P.T. Barnum Museum. We were taking the ferry over to Port Jeff in college, and the guy who worked at the P.T. Barnum Museum, he had one eye. And like he was just there. He must have been with the circus at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
And he grabbed my hand and he said, let me see your hand. And he looked at my palm and he said, you're going to get in a very bad accident.
Oh my God. Wow.
And for about 4 years.
I admire that kind of honesty.
But wait, so Kent, Connecticut, because I talked to Ted Danson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's specifically about the Kent school where you went.
Yep.
And it seems like you two were it.
Yeah,
and he gets credit for going there.
I think Lana Del Rey also went to Kent. I think it's the three of us.
But you grew up there.
Yes.
And what is that like? It's a very small town.
Really small town. Very idyllic. Very Beaver Cleaver kind.
Really?
Of. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was like you hear people say, but that was a great place to grow up. This is like the cookie cutter, gorgeous, peaceful, calm. Wholesome place to
grow
up.
Was it a great place to grow up?
It was, actually, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I go back there every, you know, whenever I can.
You do?
Yeah, it's
You have family there still?
I have grade school friends that I still talk to.
Grade school?
Yeah, yeah.
You check in with them like yearly? Or
biannually.
Isn't it kind of weird?
It's kind of weird.
Because you don't have kids, right?
No,
and you don't have, me neither. So you kind of need to check in with those people to see that you're aging.
Yeah, yeah. It is. That is a really, it is, yeah, it's a good barometer because you look at everyone else, you're like, my God, everyone looks so fucking old.
Yeah.
Well, I don't look like that. And then, the odds are you're not the only one in the room
right.
who has retained.
Yeah, and how can you know?
Like, you can't.
I took a picture of myself this morning for a thing, and I'm like, it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just, you know, it's like, there's some moment, like I'm 55, and it's right around this time where it's like, you turn into the old man. Because you see it with presidents, you know, they start out like, oh, look, he's young. And then like within 4 years, it's like, oh, and it's around in the 50s.
Yeah.
Feel it happening.
Yeah.
You?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm starting to see things that, you know.
Like, what's that bump? Those kind of things?
Boy, the weenus is a little flappier than it used to be.
Who was that? One of those guys, I can't remember. He's been on the show, writer. Fuck. He tweeted once. He said, I had a bad case of dad dick this morning. I thought that was genius. I was like one of the best.
Just this morning.
Yeah.
Not every day.
Today was I noticed it. Dad dick's problem. It's a problem. But I have a friend of a friend who says that there are people in that town. This guy, I think, he's in Kent. He runs an excavating business. And I've heard his name is Bill. And he's got a character you did of him when you were like 10 or something.
Wow.
He said, probably. I've heard that there are many people in town that have found these caricatures that you did of people.
Yeah.
And now they're on the wall because of who you are. Did you have a caricature business?
I did, you know, when I was really, really young, my father was a butcher at the local grocery store.
Is that
store.
True?
Yeah.
I don't know why you'd make that up.
He was a teacher and he worked part-time as a butcher. And I would go into the grocery store and like draw on the grocery bags. Before the groceries were bagged, and then eventually graduated to doing sidewalk caricatures on the street during the summer fair days. Yes, there were summer fair days. It was an idyllic town.
Sure. Yeah,
and I did a bunch of them.
For money.
Yeah.
So when does this start? Like, because it seems like this was an obsession that, you know, obviously turned into a $1 billion a year industry. But I mean, at what point do you sort of retreat into paper?
You know, I tend to be those are the parts of the process that I actually enjoy the most. I'm a little bit of an introvert by nature.
Well, you must have been just sitting there drawing all the time.
Yeah.
So like why do you ever think about that?
why am I an introvert?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that was you know, the craft that I gravitated to when I was young was something that was a solitary craft, and that's just what I got comfortable with.
But because I mean, I used to draw when I was a kid, and you know, you can get lost for hours hours, but you sort of stuck with it, and there's a relief to it. But you seem to like, I guess it's better when you have a true knack for something where you can look at things and go like, no, I'm pretty good at this.
yeah, it's you know, I at the time thought, okay, I think I have a pretty good handle on this. But it is, you know, it the result is, you know, I enjoy writing, I enjoy post-production. You know, the most stressful part of a film or a television show for me is the production, where there's tons of people around.
Yeah.
It's a big crowd, it's very bustling. Like, that's the part where I'm the most kind of uptight.
But were you always like that, like as a kid?
I hated, I got better as I got into college.
Right.
But I got, you know, it was a long time where I just hated going to parties. Like, the whole idea was just so...
Because of the noise and just the
demands. Because of the noise, the loudness, people. The energy, the intensity is just too much.
Really?
Yeah.
And
then I discovered alcohol, and I was like, oh, that's what was
missing.
That's the key ingredient.
This is what I need to feel whole.
To this day, man, I tell you, it's like you go to a party sober, and it's parties are terrible.
But did you quit drinking?
The only reason we think they're so great is because we're drunk.
Right, and then you have to deal with the repercussions of that.
Yep.
Like, you know, I don't love parties. I find myself, if I get invited to something, there's a long month or two of like, no, I gotta, fuck, I'm just gonna be there. What am I gonna do?
Yeah.
Once I get there, I'm all right. But then you got to worry about what people say afterwards.
Yeah, it's all.
Did you stop drinking?
Big mess. No, God, no.
No.
No. Rather the reverse, sir.
Oh, really? But when did you start?
No, I
high school?
College, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You waited.
Yeah, I waited. I probably would have enjoyed high school more if I had a good high school experience, but I you know, in college it was like, oh, okay, this is what.
But in high school, like, so you're this guy's drawing pictures, and like, was that the key to your, you know, sort of like, because, like, I know being a funny guy in high school, you could just kind of move through all groups because you were the funny guy.
Yeah.
So did you walk around?
There was a little bit of
showing
that.
Your pictures.
There
to
was
people?
A little bit. There was a little bit of that.
Look, like me. Yeah, I drew you.
Exactly. You're not too far off. Yeah. It is. I mean, it's people give you a little bit as I recall, I was given a little bit of a respectful berth.
Right. Because you were the weird kid drawing, but the drawings were cool.
B-E-R-T-H, not B-I.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of figured, all right, this guy seems to know, he seems to be on a trajectory to something, and we're just going to kind of let him do his thing and not beat the shit out of him. So thank you,
leave the
classmates.
Kid with the pencil alone.
Yes, thank you for not beating the shit out of him.
But were you like, would you, because you seem like you're pretty, I mean, were you, do you think you were like a nerdy kid or?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And what was it like?
Not in the traditional sense, but yes.
Because I saw some of this stuff, like when you started doing actual cartoons for the paper. Like, you know, when I was a kid, like, who were the guys that you were? Because I liked, what's that guy's name? Gahan Wilson?
Wilson.
The guy from the Playboy. He did like, oh, he's a great cartoonist.
Yeah.
But like the single panel stuff.
Yeah.
Like, were you reading Mad Magazine? Were you looking at?
I liked Mad. The Far Side was the thing that really was groundbreaking for me.
Yeah, your generation, I guess.
Yeah, that was like that just altered my whole perception of, and God, you look at those panels now.
Yeah.
And they're so great and they're so classic, but you remember at the time there were if there had been bloggers then,
right?
If there had been think pieces, they would have torn them to shreds. Like, people were like, this is horrific, this is offensive. But they were brilliant.
They're great. Yeah. Well, that's just sort of a problem, because like, even in some of those old panels, I could see you were drawing from a grown-up world that, you know, there was an edge to them.
Yeah.
And you already had a cynicism, but it might not have been yours. Was it yours, did you think?
A lot of it came from my family. My family was like, you know, we're a happy family, but there was like a healthy cynicism. There was like a really, certainly on my mother's side of the family, there was a very... They were big laughers.
Yeah.
A really dark sense of humor.
Like really?
A lot of stuff that just wouldn't fly now.
That's great.
But the, yeah, but that was very.
Were they progressive people?
They were, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like what did you, your dad was a butcher and a teacher?
Yeah.
And your mom?
Yeah, she was in college guidance at the Kent School, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
So there was a premium put on education,
yes.
Creativity,
yeah.
Let the kid do what he wants and exactly. Then rein him in if you need to.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And you got, one sister?
One sister, yeah.
Now, were they were they WASPy people?
They weren't. They were both kind of ex-hippies. My dad was at Woodstock and,
really?
You know, had his share of LSD stories.
Really?
The good stuff. Yeah.
So he told you about Woodstock?
Yeah.
Did he live on a commune? Did he do the whole thing?
He didn't go that far, but he was, you know, he was a folk singer.
Really?
And that's how my parents met. My mother went to a pub in Massachusetts and my dad was up on stage playing the guitar. And my mother found out where he lived. And it's not the healthiest story,
actually. Stalked him?
Yeah, stalked him, banged on his door, asked for guitar lessons, and basically just, you know, went at him like a praying mantis.
And so he's a folk singer. So
yeah.
There's guitars around the house. Did you like your dad's music?
It was kind of weird because like I was
feels very, like you're pushing back a little now.
Yeah, but I guess you know he was in you know this was the counterculture music. So I guess my way of rebelling was gravitating towards the Sinatra.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll show him.
Yeah, what was good. These kids, they don't know what's good.
But yeah, you know, no, I wasn't, you know, they were the Simon and Garfunkel, Peter, Paul, and Mary,
yeah.
You know, Rita Coolidge.
Ooh, Rita Coolidge. Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some sadness there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was what was in the house.
That was what was
record?
In the house, yeah.
And you didn't like it then?
I was fine with it. It just, I gravitated a bit more towards Fuller, you know, I loved orchestra. I loved film scores. I was like a big John Williams fan
nine?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Loved John Williams.
It actually connected with you at that
yeah.
age
oh,
where
yeah.
you could hear like that music is doing something?
And yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because usually when you're nine, you're like, I like the movie.
I was, you know, it was a very musical town. We had a choir director that would put on these Gilbert and Sullivan shows. So we were all doing like fucking Gilbert and Sullivan at 8 and 9.
Oh, you're in the shows.
Yeah.
So you're doing musicals.
Yeah.
Because I noticed, and, like, when you hosted the Oscar, I was like, this is a song and dance man. What is this? This guy's not a cartoon guy. Look at him. He just wants to dance.
He just wants to dance. That's all he wants to do.
It kind of is, right?
I mean, you know, who doesn't enjoy that?
It scares me.
Oh, wasn't that, what was the reason you become a DJ so you don't have to dance?
Or be seen.
I remember going to the, or be seen.
At all.
I remember going to the Derby
yeah.
at one point when that was still around. And I was like, and I'm not
with a good. With the swing thing?
Yeah, I'm not a good dancer. And there's a guy on stage singing. And I'm like, I want to be that guy. He doesn't have to deal with any of this shit.
Right.
He never has to get on the dance floor.
and he can still be cool.
And yet he's still cool.
Yeah. He's driving the whole thing.
Exactly,
that guy.
Exactly.
Well, like Favreau was a big swing guy, right? And you work with him a lot, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
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 But you don't see yourself as part of that thing because that was sort of a trendy thing. It seems that, like, there were a lot of guys wearing zoot suits and jumping around. And
yeah, there's lounge swing, and then there's true. You know, to me, the best Sinatra recordings are his ballad albums.
Uh-huh.
Are, you know, Only the Lonely and Where Are You and No One Cares. You know, the stuff that's like that's where there's the minute long orchestral intro before he even starts singing.
the big bill.
Yeah.
The strings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you read Dino by Nick Tosches?
No.
Oh,
no.
Dude. Come on.
Listen, I'll Amazon it right now.
It's this poetic, dark investigation into the soul of Dean Martin.
Really?
Oh my God!
When did it come out?
It's a classic. Geez, it's got to be maybe the early '80s. Dino, Nick Tosches. He's a very dark guy and a very dark writer, and it's a biography of Dean Martin that you know just it. It's you know whether
there is.
Yeah, whether you whether I don't know how much of it is poetic speculation, but there's a lot of history in there, and it's very well researched.
What a title. Yeah. Dino, Living High in the Dirty Business of Dreams.
Yeah, dude. You gotta. He's written a couple of great books, Tosches. But like I didn't realize that Dean Martin, a couple of things, that there was these guys that set these precedents, like Bing Crosby, that like Dean Martin, you know, got into the racket to just be sort of a Crosby knockoff.
Yeah, well, so did, I mean, so did Sinatra. Like, they both, they idolized Crosby.
Yeah. And it's like the phrasing and everything. But no, and nobody, like, who knows about that shit now? Is there part of what you're doing now? Because it seems to be a real focus for you. I mean, did Grammy-nominated swing records. I mean, is there some part of you that's sort of like, you got to respect these guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, it was an era of high musicality where every part of the equation was its own deal. I mean, if you take a song like that everybody knows, like I've Got You Under My Skin, you know, Cole Porter wrote the song. He was revered for his craft. Nelson Riddle did the arrangement. He was revered for his craft. Sinatra sang the song. He was revered for his craft. It was this amazing collaboration of talent.
And also, back in the day, you know, if you wanted to go to a dance, you know, there were 30 guys on stage.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
and that was just normal. They had to have room for that shit.
Yeah, it cost you. You watch the Grammys, you know, what, 40 years ago or whatever it was, and there's Henry Mancini playing the Pink Panther theme with like a 40-piece orchestra behind him.
It is really something that's all gone away.
It's gone away. And I don't think it's just an evolution. I think it's a cheapening. I think it's less expensive to not do it.
Yeah, it's less expensive, and also like, and they've somehow, not unlike with movies and stuff, they've over time just hypnotized people into believing that this was good.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And but I don't know that there's any coming back to that. And I don't know.
No, I mean, I don't. It's this. I mean, that's why we do these records, is that just kind of say, look, that this can still be done. You know, you can still make music that has a real, you know, that has a lot of different music. And I'm just talking from a technical standpoint. Yeah. You know, layers to it. It's just a hard thing. It's just kind of vanished.
And the first time that you sort of got like engaged with this was when you did the Family Guy episode, the Vegas episode. Was that the first time where you realized like, wow, I have freedom. I can put together as many musicians as I want.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, The Simpsons did it for a number of years. Yeah. I mean, they were one of the few shows left on the air that used a live orchestra. And so we decided to, you know, God, if they can get away with it, maybe we can too. And we were able to pull it off, and it just makes a huge difference. I do think that even if an audience doesn't know that what they're hearing on a show like Family Guy is live music, is a live orchestra, on a subconscious level, it just makes the show a little bit more resonant
and authentic somehow.
Yeah.
And what's all interesting to that, like, I'm not a huge animation guy, you should know.
Yeah, you know, believe it or not, neither am I.
but I think that's true. There's like things I've learned over time. But like the interesting thing about orchestras is each one of those guys has a story. You know, you read about like big bands and the ones that kind of spun off onto heroin and then became bebop guys and just drove their lives into a ditch.
You know, it's to me the biggest problem is it's the source of the creative, the creative impetus has fallen out of the hands of the composer and into the hands of the producer. And it's an oversimplification, but it's true. I mean, it's you, a producer cannot give you what, you know, George Gershwin could have given you.
It almost makes you cry.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
To feel the, you know, you can feel all the instruments in the right room.
Yep.
And
yep.
It's such a beautiful, life embracing thing that's just gone.
Yeah. It's an interesting point, because it's hard to think of anything in recent years that has evoked, you know, that I've listened to, that's gotten me to that point where it's like, oh, I'm listening to this music, I could cry, but it's
for the right reasons,
for the right reasons, absolutely, yeah.
But when you do it though, you're very meticulous about it. I mean, I don't know how much you go through. I was just, my buddy, my producer, said he was listening to a Christmas record, you know, and you did a Christmas record. And he said, it's very clear that Seth wants to do the best version of these songs. he just felt it that, like, you know, you're out to kill this thing.
Well, you know, there was a secret to my theory is, look, Sinatra was a vocalist who surpassed any of his contemporaries.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think part of that is the fact that his secret weapon is he understood better than anybody what an orchestration, what an arrangement, what an orchestra can do for you, and the cushion it can give you can just make you sound better. And his orchestrations are just light years beyond anything else that was being written. You know, that's with the records that we do, it's the same thing. It's like, it's not just about singing the songs, it's a showcase for the orchestra.
Right. And you you got nominated for a Grammy for the one you wrote for an Academy Award for the was it from Ted?
From Ted, yeah.
Yeah, for that song.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself as is that going to be a thing you do? Are you going to be Randy Newman? Are people going
to? I can't, you know, I would love to be able to write for orchestra. I'd have to go back to school for years and.
So now you just you write the things and you say to the guys, like, can you put something together?
You know what? It's the one part for me that's retained this kind of mystery because I work with composers that I love, but I'm not able to orchestrate myself.
You can't say, can we take it to the nine after that?
Yeah. My communication skills have gotten better. Like I can say, you know, can we make that a little more rubato, which I didn't used to be able to do. But
before
it was like longer.
Yeah.
but it is the one part of the process for me that I kind of like the fact that it's still sort of this magical thing that I don't completely understand.
Right, right, right. And you got guys that know what they're doing and you can be sort of like enchanted by it.
Yeah.
As opposed to sort of like, no, you got to bring up the oboe.
Exactly.
You
say,
exactly. You don't want to be that guy, then all the love is gone.
I think I have been that guy once or twice, but. Oh,
well, thanks for copping to it. That's Biggie. You shit on the oboe guy.
I know. There's so few of them too.
I know. It's hard for those guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, tough being a...
Yeah, man.
So when did you think you started enjoying, pissing people off? Like, when did that... Because it must have happened with the comics.
Yeah, it did, actually. I used to do a weekly comic strip for our local paper in Kent. And I did one when I was, 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And it was a guy taking communion...
Yeah,
and he says, "Can I have fries with that?"
Right,
and I was like, when I was we went to church because I was in a choir. We weren't a religious family, but we went. I was always
Catholic,
Episcopalian.
Okay,
and I was always just weirdly confused and fascinated by communion. The whole process was just so creepy and
whole thing is witchcraft.
Yeah, it was just such a strange, weird thing. Like I didn't get it. I still don't get it.
It's ritual magic.
They're putting these little wafers on the tongue and, you know, like, I kind of want to know what they taste like, but these, look at these adults kneeling while other adults put things in their mouths.
Better than
I
kids.
Guess that's all over the internet, but right. I did this comic strip and I got an angry letter from the local priest.
Yeah.
Who said, shame on you for insulting the Almighty God and those who love him.
And you're like, yeah.
And down below he had written, do you like me? Check yes, no, or maybe. No,
meet me in the rectory.
It was a very interesting thing to kind of process at that age.
How old were you?
I was like 9 or 10.
And can you remember how you processed it? Was it a good feeling or did you feel horrible?
I didn't because my parents helped me to, you know, they said, look, this is, you made, I don't think they particularly liked the guy anyway. So
right.
I think they were like, yeah, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
But they kind of said, look, this is, you got a reaction from something you did artistically and that's neither good nor bad. It's just what you want out of it. And so they had a very kind of.
Really?
Sophisticated attitude about it.
It's diplomatic.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't say, like, sometimes when you do satire, the object of it is actually to piss these guys off.
Exactly.
This is exactly what you need to be doing with your life.
Yeah. I mean, that would have been, I mean, their sense of humor was so, like, I mean, it was just shit.
Dark.
It was dark.
So that was normal to you.
Yeah, yeah. That was probably, like, on the lighter side of the spectrum.
Yeah, I remember like there was a moment like I for some reason whatever this is triggering in me that there was a moment when I was with my parents on a ski trip with another couple and their kids, and one of the other couple said like if you were on the mountain and one of you died and you were stuck up there, which part of them would you eat first? And I must be like 8. Yeah. And my mother goes, the penis, at least I'm used to that. And I'm like, that's where I get it.
That is my mother was exactly the same way. That is exactly the kind of thing that would have come out of her mouth. Yeah.
And so that gets normalized, and that's a fucking gift, really.
Yeah.
So like, you know,
my mother, there was a line in Wayne's World that my mother was like thought was the funniest thing, and she would butcher it when she would retell it. But it was the scene where Wayne's on the phone to the Chinese restaurant, and he goes, yes, I'll have the cream of some young guy. And my mother would tell this at parts. Have you seen the movie? It's hilarious. He's on the phone with his Chinese restaurant, and he says, I'll have the cream of some young guy.
Delivery is her own.
There was a handful of jokes, and now they're all coming back to me, that my mother would tell in all kinds of company. There was a joke that she told over and over and over, where a male grocery bagger walks out to the car with a bag of groceries and for this woman, and the woman says, you know, in a flirtatious way, I have an itchy pussy. And the guy goes, you know, I get all those Japanese cars mixed up. And my mother would tell this joke to everyone she met. It's like, you instantly know what you were
dealing
with.
It seems like she liked the Asian themed joke.
My God, that may be it.
Something about the language mix-up.
What a breakthrough.
Yeah, it's just weird, like that moment where, I don't know, man. Something just happened on this set of Glow the other day. Like, I'm in that show Glow, you know? So it's me, and it's just like all women. And I don't know why, like, you're always waiting, like, you know, like, I keep my mouth shut, I behave, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not a chore for me. You know, it's fine. I'm just working in a cast and I love them all and everything. But there was a moment the other day where I'm on set and we start a take and I go into it and I fuck the lines up. And for no reason, just because I do it sometimes on the mic when I'm doing my monologues, I just went, ah, fucking cunt. And I, you know, and I'm like, why?
Did it go over well?
No. It was like I walked up to the AD and I said, do I need to apologize for that? It wasn't directed at anybody. It was really just a moment of frustration. And she's like, no, it's fine. But like, but I had like a whole day of like, why that word?
There's probably like 100 of those in the script, I would imagine.
No, no cunts.
Really?
No cunts, no.
It's like an HBO show, right?
No, it's on Netflix, but no, it's not that kind of show. Yeah. It's about women wrestlers in the '80s. But it wasn't completely out of character. But it's just one of those things. Like sometimes I'll do it here,
right.
Like if I'm redoing an ad read, and it's not for my producer. It's just what I do. I've got fucking balls. You know, say it because it feels good.
I think most people, you know, most reasonable people sexes are just gonna see that for what it is.
Of course.
It's an expletive.
And it feels good. Yeah, there was a moment of like, wait, that word?
Yeah.
But it wasn't, no.
I could be right. You know, I'm at Mr. Straight White Male here saying, I think it's fine. I can't see the problem.
No, I think you're right. And it was clearly just a thing that, you know, it was just, an expletive. But like, but talking about offending people, because like in your hometown, and I know you've probably talked about this a lot, but like the pushback from that one guy in your own town that almost sunk fucking Family Guy, have you gone into the history of that guy?
You know,
the Griffin guy, Griffin was his secretary and he was the headmaster of the school.
God. Yeah, that was an interesting experience because it's like your high school principal calling you as an adult.
Yeah.
And you know, asking you to do something. And it's like, well, that doesn't really work anymore.
But it was just the name, right? So how long had the show been on?
It was the name. Yeah, the show hadn't premiered yet.
How did he know?
I think there was a lot of press.
Okay.
There was a lot of press about it. And you know, it's something that just never occurred to me. Like writers take... Like writers take names of people that they know, or their last names, first names. You just
draw from
wherever. And if there's a resemblance, there's a team of lawyers, the studio, and the network. Is there one Chuck Emmerich in this town, or are there 50?
Yeah, right,
if there are 50,
right.
You're fine.
Right.
If there's one, then he's got a potential case.
Plenty of Griffins in the world.
Yeah. So it was the issue was that there was. I think a panic about, you know, is this about us? And it wasn't. It was a name that I was like, this is going to be a show about an Irish family, and that was a name that I chose.
But it wasn't even him, right? It was someone who worked for him.
It was sort of a murky kind of thing.
Oh yeah,
that went down. I never really got the full.
You don't know the backstory?
Never really got the full, all the details.
Really?
Yeah.
But it caused you trouble.
It caused a little bit of a flap.
Yeah,
caused a little bit of a flap.
He aligned himself with the parents, whatever council.
The parents' television council. Yeah, it's interesting. That's an organization that, you know, it's historically been a contentious relationship with Family Guy.
What's the guy's name? Brent Bozell?
He's gone. That guy was a nut. It's the fellow running it now is, you know, I actually had drinks with him a couple times and is a terrific guy. You know, like he has his job their job is to police the networks. But you know, you can have
in the name of kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Supposedly.
It is in the name of decency and taste, and
right.
but it's nice that it was interesting to find. Oh, we can actually have a conversation in a friendly way, and it was a nice surprise. And it came about, I think we had written a letter to the Parents Television Council saying, listen, we invite you guys to write an episode if you think you can do this better than we can.
Oh, good, that's a good way to handle it.
And the letter we got back was, you know, and it was sort of a way of trying to make a point. The letter we got back was very kind and respectful, and so I reached out to the guy and said, hey, thanks a lot, and ended up becoming friendly with him. So
keep your enemies closer? Is that
the... I guess.
Well, I mean, the whole genre of animation that, you know, at some point, I think before you, you know, there was grown-up animation always, you know, kind of, you know, Betty Boop, Wizards, whatever the stuff I saw when I was a kid. But there was a point on television where it appealed to both kids and adults.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what the freedom there was, you know, how much are you filling a kid's head with, I guess, was a real predicament for the moralizers.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, who's this for? Is this, like, you know, how did they, you know, look at cartoons? There was always a subtext, but by the time The Simpsons came on, certainly by Family Guy, it was like, it's not a subtext.
Yeah, yeah, and that was part of the conflict, is that that was still a period where cartoons were for kids. You know, it's interesting. I this is sort of the first generation of adults that has held on to the practice of watching cartoons and reading comic books, and it used to be something you left behind, but
I do a joke about that.
Really?
Yeah. Like I said, I read some comics when I was 9, but at 11, I decided I'm not going to make this my life. I think it's some sort of belief system. I think it's beyond entertainment.
Yeah. There's a passion there it's something that I probably should be able to lock into with what I do for a living. It's hard for me. Like I've seen maybe 2 superhero movies, in the past 10 years.
Yeah. It's just like, it's a choice. I'm not sort of like, fuck that, but I don't think to do it.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
And
I don't either.
I think there's also a fear that, like, well, what if I become one? You know, like I've made it this far. But what do you think, like, in terms of offending people, because I know it's on, you know, my mind as a comic, it's on your mind because it's come up a couple times already, just, you know, in passing. But like, even the Oscars, so they didn't ask you to host, right?
No, not this year. Not this year. Hasn't come up yet.
You're the last guy in the list, right?
Yeah,
do you want to go back to him? Would you do it again?
I don't know. I got asked back the year after I hosted. I guess because the numbers had gone up, and so they asked me back, and I was making the Western comedy that I made in Santa Fe, and I was so wrapped up in that, and I thought, you know, I there's no way I'm going to be able to finish this and stay alive if I try to do the Oscars as well. And, you know, part of me wanted to say yes, and I realized, God, you know, the only reason I'd be saying yes is to kind of, you know, show up the detractors, and it's just not a good enough reason.
Is that a new shift for you?
No. Even at the time, it was.
But I mean,
it just was not to put in that kind of work. It was. I love having done it.
Yeah.
It was a thrill, as, you know, to do it. It was a great experience, and it was, I think the, you know, what it did for, you know, it opened up a lot of doors for me for other things, and
it did.
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, just the visibility you get from the Oscars is
but mostly as a live performer, you think?
Yeah, I think yeah. it's sort of a real boost in that regard. But it's something that I don't know what the upside is of doing it at this point in time.
Right. But I think that's what everybody's realizing. But I think that, but just looking back and how the culture has changed over, you know, since you've done it, which was what, 5 years ago? How long ago?
About 5 years ago.
So like, do you think you could do, we saw your boobs again?
I mean,
would it even accommodate your personality at all?
What's interesting is that thing came about, and I've never mentioned this, but like that gag came about because I read the you know, a lot of the press, which you should never do. I know this now. You should never read any of your own press. But, you know, I read a lot of press.
Stay away from the computer altogether.
Yes, completely. But I read a lot of press leading up to the Oscars, and it was a lot of like really angry, foaming at the mouth kind of stuff that was just like, oh, I bet I know what he's going to do and I hate him for it, you know, from a lot of these outlets. And
from the left and the right?
No, I think mostly from like the Hollywood press.
Oh, okay.
More from the left.
Not a political. Oh, yeah. Okay.
But it's, and it got to the point where like, God, I have to sort of comment on this in some way. I mean, I can't just go up and, you know, because my original idea was very kind of tame and very kind of old style song and dance. And I thought, God, this is like, I gotta, it's, you know, in a way, it's like you helped create what you despise, but so it was this idea of,
you felt challenged,
yeah, in a way,
yeah,
and it was the idea of this creating this alternate Oscars that was exactly what they were afraid would happen,
right?
And that's the part that gets a little forgotten,
yeah.
They always forget context.
Clickbait is essentially lack of context.
Yeah,
it's taken out of context.
It's the only way that industry works.
Yeah,
it's. But that was the thing, and you know, it's hard to know how I would approach it if I host it again.
Yeah,
it's hard to I mean, because there's just there is no upside, because it's a very, you know, look, it's a very visible, high profile thing that
not according to
all eyes
ratings.
On it.
I mean, isn't that the big problem?
True.
Maybe press visibility, but
it's an easy thing to shit on.
Yeah,
like it's so easy to shit on the Oscars because it's all you got to do is you don't have to read the news. You don't have to know history.
Yeah.
You don't have to do any work.
Yeah.
All you have to do is sit down, watch, and tweet or write.
Yeah.
That's all you got to do.
Yeah, and just and also because
it takes it takes a lot. You see a lot more outrage about a tempestuous Oscars than you do about a piece of harmful legislation.
There's no winning either side.
Yeah.
Because I would imagine most people who think Hollywood is some sort of bastion of evil, they don't watch it. I used to like watching it just because I like seeing movie stars.
But I think a lot of that is an example. It's the loudest voices controlling the conversation. I think most people, you know, look, I can sit down, as I said before, I can sit down and have a conversation with the head of the Parents Television Council. I'll go even further than that. I've had conversations, civil conversations with Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
I mean,
Rush Limbaugh.
You can disagree with someone and
no, that's true. That's
and
true.
Have a civil discourse. It is, it's a lot. And I think a lot more people are able to do it than we think right now.
No, I agree with that. But the problem is that, and you know from show business, is that, yeah, you can have those conversations, but then he'll go like, I got to get back on the mic. This guy, Seth MacFarlane, came in here, you know, and so like there's a public, you know, those guys who have control of the public narrative and their humanity can be very different things.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's true. But I mean, once you have, you know, that,
I'm not claiming he has humanity.
Once there's a face to face interaction,
sure, everybody buckles.
It gets a lot harder, and that's where the internet is so destructive. Is that,
yeah? Because you could do it anonymously, but I can't tell you how many comics I know. They're like, I knew Trump when he was, you know, on Stern.
Yeah.
I mean, you listen to him, Stern, and Jeff Ross has been on his plane, and it's like,
well, you know, I think that was before the deification. I think whoever you are, you have to be made of the strongest stuff.
To survive deification?
To survive that kind of lionization when you're standing in front of a crowd of thousands of people who are treating you like a god.
Yeah.
Unless you are made, and Trump is not strong enough to handle. And in some ways, you know, you saw little inklings at the last debate where, you know, Bernie might have been getting into it a little bit.
Sure.
He was maybe feeling a little bit, you know, lionized.
Elevate,
and
yeah.
Yeah. And not, you know, he's made of much stronger stuff than Trump is, but you know, you have to be superhuman to be a really special kind of person to avoid that.
To maintain at least a false sense of humility.
Yeah, yeah. You have to maintain a healthy amount of self-loathing.
To stay humble. Well, I mean, I've been trying to sell this joke on stage. I can't quite do it yet about how in the world of narcissists. You know, Trump is a tremendous success because he's actually achieved in making it everything about him.
Yeah.
He's a hero to narcissists.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually all about him. Literally. He did it.
And you know, you wonder how much of it is, you know, he's obsessed with brand.
He's mentally ill.
This point is mentally ill. But you know, he's obsessed with brand and he's probably thinking to himself, you know, when I'm done with this, I'll be able to start the conservative news outlet to rival Fox News and
only if he can do it from prison.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's what I think is going on in his head. That he's thinking, if I got to do is hang on to this base,
so I can
I make money off it it's done.
That's
which
right.
Is probably all he wanted to do in the first place. I mean, that's the rumor is that he just never really wanted the gig.
Now we're here. I can't find any. I don't have any sympathy for his plight.
No, I don't either.
But let me ask you on the other thing, like, you know, in most of the shows, certainly in Family Guy, that there was the idea was the Rickelson, the Rickles, like, you know, equal opportunity offender thing. But now that, you know, there are people that specifically put Trump in office so they could, you know, shamelessly say those words and have those ideas. That, you know, what place does it, what is the conversation for you now in your head about what it means to still do that? Or I know you're a little distanced from it now.
Yeah.
And by the way,
that's one of the reasons that I am distanced from it is that it's a tightrope that,
it's almost impossible.
Yeah. It's not enjoyable anymore because, you know, comedy used to be this kind of, if you'll pardon the term, safe space that.
You can use that term.
Could kind of exist in its own little bubble, and you know it's. I mean, you know, when you have your sensitivity seminars that every corporation does nowadays, it's an interesting little asterisk that because the one thing they say is, you know, in the context of that writer's room, of that creative space, it's sort of a different set of rules because you have to have the creative freedom to just spitball whatever, particularly in comedy. And that is still protected. You know, it's not like that's gone out the window. For the most part, within reason, it's still protected, at least in my experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, comedy writing rooms are like it must have been like your family. I mean, dark.
Yeah. I mean,
loose.
It's the way to put it. You know, I mean, it has to be this, and you have to respect people and you have to treat people but you also have to have the freedom to
push
and figure out where that line is.
Yeah.
And sometimes you cross it.
Right.
So that part of it is, you know, it's when it gets out into the public, that's the part it's too stressful now for a lot of people. And I, you know, I love what I'm doing now because I just don't have to really deal with that as much. I am distanced from Family Guy. But as far as what it does to the conversation and what it does to the medium, I mean, animation is strangely in its own sector. You know, these aren't real. These aren't faces. It's different than sending a tweet.
You have a freedom. No, but also, like, what happens if we just, in a broad sense, become afraid of even trying to find that line?
And I think that's the problem. And again, I don't think that reasonable people, I don't buy that. I don't know anyone who would be offended by. And I've worked with, you know, I've been in this business for 20 years. I don't know anyone who would be actively offended by, you know, anything that is, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there are people who would have been offended by what you said on the set,
right.
But I don't know. I think Everyone that I know would have said, yeah, this is, you know, even people who are maybe uncomfortable, it's like, yeah, you know, he's pissed. He had a moment.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's this, there's this kind of sense that there's a witch hunt.
It's not a, oh, you're saying
I don't
that
think that's true.
It's not most people. It's a few people in a sense that, that put their life into being, you know, oversensitive.
To being angry about comedy. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that, you know, things that get me mad, things that get me angry, you know, it's science denial. It's social injustice. It's, you know, read an article about mass incarceration. These things piss me off.
Right.
I don't ever remember feeling any rage at anything I heard in a fictional setting.
Yeah.
In a television show or a film or a stand-up routine, which is a form of storytelling.
Right. But isn't it interesting though, because, you know, just professionally and also personally as people that sort of, you know, broker and funny, that you may not be offended, but when you watch it now, you're sort of like, no, that's going to offend somebody.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, again, it's like, as I say, it's easy for me as, you know, again, straight white male, it's easy for me to say that. So I'm coming at this from a place where I'm not entirely, you know, I don't have all the tools for proper perception of
well,
that.
Well, I think that's probably the most important you know, outcome in terms of women, you know, ethnic groups, is that that finally there is a sensitivity and an empathy that probably wasn't there. And, and I think that's healthy.
Absolutely.
But then how do you shit on them?
Well, because, you know, I think that's...
I should reframe that a little bit. There was the idea of using stereotypes or being an equal opportunity offender or investigating, you know, the differences between people. There was something humanizing about it, and it was not in its best form meant to be isolating or hateful.
I think we'll find that balance again. I think, you know, Ronan Farrow pointed out that when you have this kind of a sudden release of oppression, it's gonna be like opening a floodgate.
Yeah,
I mean, it's gonna be big and loud and forceful, and that's, you know, that's justified at the outset. And I think, you know, at a certain point, it's just gonna be a matter of, okay, once we've acknowledged the problems and we actively seek to correct them, then I think we'll be able to find some equilibrium.
Right, that's right. I think that's true. But I also think that in terms of clickbait, the internet in general,
that's an industry. I mean, clickbait is not a productive part of this.
But that's my point, is that, and I don't talk about it too much, is that the idea that everybody, you know, has a voice that can be heard and exploited, you know, is, you know, it might be at some other juncture in history a democratic ideal, but now it's just become like a malignancy.
Well, now you can't get anything done. I mean,
right.
you can't have a discussion with, you know, 50 million people. I mean, you have to, the whole thing of, there's a reason we elect representatives,
right,
to go and have these discussions in smaller groups and arrive at.
And it's not some guy named at Slingblade.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, no, it's there are good and bad elements I think most of Twitter is immensely destructive. I think you can point to something like, and I remember when Bruce Jenner became Caitlyn Jenner, and the internet, you know, this was all over Twitter the next day, and she was accepted in a way that I think would not have happened 10 years prior. I think 10 years prior, you would have had people at the water cooler going, my God, did you see that interview? Holy shit. What a nut, you know, but because suddenly you have this smaller community because of Twitter, because of the internet, it happened like that. I mean, it was an amazing giant leap forward. So you have these little glimmers of positivity from that, but most of it is just
right. And I think that's
cancer.
I think that's important, because I think what's happening culturally in terms of, you know, white male perspective and also the administration we have and what that's empowered, is that the one thing it seems that whoever is still on board with this shit, the one part of democracy they couldn't seem to manage or handle was tolerance.
Yeah, yeah.
And just the license to be like, I don't have to put up with this shit anymore?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's enough to crush the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think that push in terms of culture and in terms of what you're saying, the benefit of Twitter is that there's this kind of constant push for, you have to tolerate.
Yeah. Yeah. And you start to realize, too, how much it really matters. You know, a lot of Trump's base does not, they're not bothered by his crudeness, by his lack of civil discourse,
or by the fact that he's a fucking grifter.
Right, right. They're not bothered by that. But even just in how you present it's amazing how that can alter the whole. Like, it really does matter how the president conducts themselves, because it was just a different country under Obama, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that you were getting a different message from the top down. It's like and it's
stability.
One of my castmates on the Orville pointed out that it's shocking how quickly after Trump took office, a large portion of the country goes, oh my God, whoo, I can say this shit now. Well, man, it's like it's just right under the surface. And
right there, man. It's like pulling the Band-Aid off a wound that will never heal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, that thing's not going to get better.
Yeah, it's
but now we can see it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. If we make it through this, we're going to know who they all are.
It's true. It's true. But it is, we on the left have to figure out a way to, you can't sit down at Thanksgiving with your racist uncle and call him a fucking idiot and expect to get anywhere. And maybe you do think he's an idiot. Maybe he is, but it's like, but you can't go into it with that attitude. You have to go in with
a little piece of information.
Yeah,
what'd you think of that thing? That thing. What'd you think of that?
Just a calm, constructive, and it may not be. It may be frustrating, but it's. It's just the only way to let things progress.
My dad, who was never really a political guy, who voted Democrat his whole life, and now he's got whatever. He somehow watches Fox News like it's the real news. He's not politically sophisticated in any way, but he did vote for Trump, and because of whatever he felt, because he got bamboozled, he got brainwashed.
Yeah.
So like he'll say about Hannity, he seems to know what he's talking about. It's like, well, what, that's just a dumb bullshit skill. But it was weird after the last 2 days, he calls me up, my old man, he's like, I think you were right about Trump.
Yeah.
I guess you never know until you know. I'm like, no, more than half the country knew.
Yeah. But it's a problem. As hard as it is to, we all want to blame the voters. I want to blame the Trump voters for this, but you can't. It's not that simple. You can't expect. Look, a lot of us had the advantage of being armed with a certain skill set that allows us to detect bullshit. I couldn't fix a car if you paid me.
Yeah,
and yet we all need each other. You have to look at it in terms of. Are these people to blame, or is Fox News to blame? Are these people to blame, or is it Harold Hill selling the boys' band? Is it his fault, or is it the people who get suckered into it?
Well, yeah, and also my fear is that the real problem is that once you are able to sort of disassemble people's ability to assess or believe facts or truth,
yeah,
there's a good chance that those brains are broken forever.
It's a good question. I don't know. That'd be a question for a psychologist.
Because with all this antagonism of the sort of, people who consider themselves practical and working class and they're feeling that they're being condescended to by scientists.
Yeah.
And that they can be presented with scientific fact and go like, I don't know, jury's still out. It's not out. Yeah, it's not out.
That's where it gets dicey, because then it starts to affect the rest of us in a big way, when those kinds of issues come into play, and
it's scary.
And
that's scary.
It is.
But as somebody like you, in sense of you're clearly positioned as culturally and politically left, but you take a lot of shit from the left.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you handle being accused of being a misogynist or being homophobic?
Well, I've never had an interaction with anyone who's written anything like that about me, which I think is conspicuous. Like it all happens from the safety of a tweet or a blog, or you know, it's never presented to me in a way that is where it can be a conversation. So that's conspicuous, and that's allows me to sort of dismiss a lot of it as clickbait. As look, I mean, you have to, like, outrage makes money.
So you've never had somebody sit down with you on a panel, or have a debate with you and your political points of view, or because I mean, you do a lot of activism work, for the LGBT community and whatnot. So, but that is not in some way, you know, some kind of like you're not doing it out of guilt.
No, I'm doing it because that's what my parents, that's
right.
They raised me to
to
believe that those things are important. But it's also, I think, the inability to separate. You know, what I run into a lot is people watch Family Guy, and then assume that that is a microcosm of my personality,
right?
And it all goes part and parcel with this inability to separate fact from fiction that is infecting the whole country. And I think, you know, look, reality shows were kind of the first sort of
cancer.
Yeah. And then social media, Instagram, you know, what's real and what's fake. And I look back at a show like All in the Family, and it's almost like, you know, you wouldn't have blamed Norman Lear for Archie Bunker's racism.
Right.
He was showing he was parodying a certain type of personality.
Oh yes, everything happens at the same frequency.
Yeah,
and right. Yeah. That's what's happening.
And I'm not saying we're all in the family, but I'm saying that there is.
But they can't discern.
They can't distinguish.
It's a statement. They track it to a person.
Yeah,
that person's a fuck.
Exactly. And it's this oversimplification. It's an inability to make that separation, and you see it on both sides.
And then the problem is that
I think it's more destructive on the right, but you see it on both sides.
No, I think that's probably true. So how did you go to RISD and not become some sort of fucked up artist?
I was
they must have been surrounded by them.
Yeah, there were a handful. Most of the school when I was there, most of the student body was very gravitated towards fine art.
Yeah,
there was a handful of us that were a little more we gravitated toward the commercial end of things, and I was one of those.
Minded.
Yeah, I did a student film, and I had phenomenal professors at RISD. Like I had, you know, they struck just the right balance between instruction and freedom of tone.
Yeah,
and I made a student film that was sort of a rough version of a Family Guy in a lot of ways. And
is that what started it?
And I remember. Yeah. I remember one of my professors saying to me, you know, this is your one chance to do that self-expressionistic project that you may never get to do again in your whole life. And I'm just worried you're wasting it on a lot of bathroom humor. you know, God bless them. They supported the hell out of me. And
have you written that guy a Christmas card?
You know, I love them because they basically taught me all the skills I needed to make that project.
But you seem like
I got a few laughs at the screening, and they're like, "All right, maybe this guy, maybe this is his trajectory."
A comedian, you must have been like, because you seem like a pretty well managed individual personally. And I don't know how much you were drinking or whatever, but were there different camps? I mean, there must have been, you know, people going, you know, on stage or painting with blood or, you know, or doing performance art pieces and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And you were coexisting with these people. Did you have peers that were, you know, out there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were some out there people. I racking my brain to think of specifics, but nothing's coming to mind. But there were a lot of
did you appreciate heavy duty. That?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're people that you interact with, and for most of the time, they're you can converse, and you're all kind of after the same goal. You know, a few people who are kind of out there on the fringe.
Yeah.
But you know, for the most part, the guy painting with his own feces would have a beer with you an hour later.
Yeah. And go, what do you think? And then you'd be diplomatic.
Sure.
Hey, exactly. Yeah, it's interesting.
Exactly.
Doing interesting stuff. No one's going to go to the show because it smells bad.
Yeah. It's a great education in the art of bullshit too, in a lot of ways, because you had to have these sessions where you critique each other's work.
Oh yeah.
And you know, there was some really good stuff and there was some stuff that was not good, and it really taught you the politics of
diplomacy
in
criticism.
Yes.
I think, you know, find the good thing, you know, like, I
the,
like what
the
you did.
Compliment sandwich.
Yeah, that corner is interesting. The rest of it, you know.
The grain of the paper is just really, man, you must have gone to the right drugstore.
But you never tried stand-up?
I did, actually. I did when I was in college, and I did a little bit of it when I came out to L.A., and I didn't. Didn't do a whole lot.
Didn't stick?
No, you know, I liked it. I enjoyed it, and I never had a horrific experience. But it was just a lot of it wasn't where my heart was. I was drawn to film and.
Well, I like that you know, even in the single panel stuff you did when you were nine, that's joke writing. And that, you know, somehow or another, that is joke writing founded in human experience, or at least some of that. But I mean, how are you getting informed? Like, you know, because you're
it's also really hard. Well, it's really hard to write jokes.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, I know. I'd stay away from it. Yeah, you know, I just talk really... until something funny happens and I make note of it.
I mean, yeah, I when I left Family Guy and the Orville, writing the Orville is interestingly the happiest I think I've been.
Dude, I think there's some really good jokes in there because like I was watching it. Even I mean, because like there, I think the trick to it is you seem to, I don't know if you, I don't know if you like inhabiting nostalgia somehow, like, you know, whether it's the singing or Star Trek or whatever, you know, there's something about, you know, kind of rethinking these things that we're all very familiar with. But I mean, but humanizing the sort of crew, the angle of that it's just a job, I think is very funny. But there's also like and you're not doing it with a laugh track, which is always tricky, you know. There and you wouldn't do it with it, but you know there are definitely jokes there. And I kind of like the responsibility being on me to laugh alone if I'm going to laugh. You know what I mean? But even something as simple as like, can I have one of these mints? It's a marble, and like even that, like it's just so funny. And then like to set up, you know, this isn't the pilot though in the first episode, but to have that guy go, can we still drink soda? Like it's a very human question, but you know, like towards the end of the show, he's got a soda, so pays off. But that stuff is, I you know, I like it, and I like it that it's not the thrust of the show. It's not all joke to joke.
And it settled into what it eventually became when we found that balance. You know, initially there was a sense that, all right, this is, we're gonna have to, and it was self-imposed. It was this pressure to kind of do what I've been doing, lest I deviate and piss off my audience. And it was Jon Favreau who, you know, directed the pilot and read the script and essentially said to me, you know what, this is good stuff. I like this. This was a breezy read. Some of these jokes seem like you may be scared of the story that you've written, and don't be, it works. Yeah. And so I took that to heart as the show went along, and it really settled into something that was, as you say, more about just kind of regular people working in space as opposed to a sitcom that takes place on a spaceship.
No, yeah, I kind of feel that. And also because it's space, you know, the suspension of disbelief is necessary, but because it's such a familiar terrain in that it is on some level a reflection of Star Trek, right? So you're kind of, you're cool with that. And there is definitely a lot of space in space, you know, in the work environment. Like it's very tricky to create something that is so clearly a stage and just have people, you know, having these brief interactions. And, and that guy who plays your friend is very funny.
Yeah, Scott Grimes. He's fantastic.
He's very funny.
Yeah, he's great. But you know, it is the nice thing about that, you know, the bridge of a spaceship. I mean, look, even Star Trek, you know, adopted that from sci-fi that had come before. Like it's a trope that's so familiar at this point that it almost... you almost get away with it like it's an office.
Yeah.
Because people just are used to it.
Right. And they'll take it.
Yeah. So that part of it, you don't have to worry about explaining.
Right. And you don't have to worry about explaining, you know, just weird aliens around
with
regular jobs.
Right. Exactly.
You're kind of used to it. And it's like, it's not like I'm not a sci-fi guy, but you're obviously a Star Trek guy.
Yeah, I was a fan. You know, I'm not a huge sci-fi guy, but I loved The Twilight Zone.
Well, yeah.
I loved Star Trek. Anything that humanized the genre.
But do you have an opinion on the Captain Pike episode and whatnot? And
I remember them all very well.
Yeah.
I think I may have enjoyed it.
But what is it about this? Like, you seem to have a sense of a strange sense of nostalgia for things that were around long before you. Like, and I don't know whether it was, you know, coming up through Hanna-Barbera or what, like, sort of made you want to integrate yourself into this particular, these different histories of show business. Can you identify it?
I mean, look, you come out to Hollywood, and what's the thing everybody wants to do? Make a Western. I've talked to other filmmakers who are drawn to that genre.
They feel like they have to.
Well, it's something that's so, it's such a classic part of the where we work and where we live
but the weird thing is it's like it's rare. I've seen a few. I just bought a big book on the making of The Wild Bunch. I started watching that again.
Yeah.
And you know, it's very specific, and it is a thing. So you just wanted to take a crack at it.
Yeah, I mean, I was a fan of the genre. Like, I had seen a lot of Westerns.
What's your Western?
Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is probably my
favorite.
I gotta
watch that, because that's like, you know, that's one of the ones I, you know, I've seen Shane, The Searchers,
Stagecoach.
Yeah. And The Searchers is great too. And you know what, like, is a genius Western is like Clint Eastwood has made some great Westerns.
Oh yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. That Hang 'em High, I remember being very good.
But even like The Pale Rider,
like
it's such a classic structure, but The Unforgiven, it's like, I'm going to put it all in here.
Yeah.
It's all going in. And at the end where it says he went on to own a haberdashery in San Francisco is the best part of that movie.
Yeah.
Like, people with histories.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you just wanted to take credit.
Well, it was also a you know, when I would watch these things, anyway, my co-writers Alex Sulkin and Wellesley Wild had the same reaction, because we were all fans of the genre, but we'd all independently had the same reaction that, God, this is they're so cool and they're so epic in the scope, but at the same time, God, it would have been horrible to live there.
Yeah.
Like, how it's this odd combination of magnetic romanticism and just, you know, disease and death.
Yeah, everywhere, and no ability to stop it. Like, in the opening shootout in The Wild Bunch, they kill literally most of the town.
Yeah.
Trying to kill the outlaws.
Which is probably barely a town.
And it's never even spoken of. Everyone's laughing at it, you know, literally on the way away from it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, both sides.
We just want, like, what do you do? Like, if you weren't an alpha, like, what do you do? Like, the sun goes down, you go home, what do you do? You sit there and
wait for death.
That's kind of all there is to do.
I don't know. It's a good question.
I mean, I guess that's what we're all doing anyway, but
yeah, we just have a lot more things to distract us.
Yeah.
But
what it's all about.
And like, what drove, like, I know anthropomorphizing is part and parcel to the line of work you're in, but like, what, you know, it's one of the great gifts of animation.
Yes.
You can make anything talk.
Yeah.
But like, what compelled you to do Ted?
I liked that there was something that was, but look, I mean, you know, that goes back to The Far Side too. Like, one of the fundamental tropes of The Far Side was this conventionalizing of talking animals.
Yeah.
There's one that I remember. There are two cows that are like sitting in their living room, and the wife cow has like all these pearls and like this, you know, wearing this beautiful dress and is like just clearly living a very good life. And the caption is just, Wendell, I'm not content. And it was just such an awesome non-joke that just like, why this needs to be two cows.
Yeah.
And so that was the idea. I just hadn't seen anything. I hadn't seen anything like Ted. I hadn't seen that part of the story told. Where, okay, after the fairy tale is done,
yeah,
you know, show me the show me the toy that, you know, look, there's always the trope of only the pets can hear each other talk, or only the toys can hear each other talk,
right?
And the humans can't. And that, and I was always kind of partial to the Muppets. Like, the fact that the Muppets were just kind of walking around, Kermit and Fozzie worked for a newspaper in right. one of the movies, and it wasn't, oh my God, that frog can talk. It was like, man, that frog was just really passive aggressive with me.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the age of CGI, I thought, God, you know, I haven't seen this done yet. And where just everything about this character is treated as human and casual and normal and just mundane and boring, yeah. except for the fact that he's a talking bear.
Yeah. So it's sort of like it's a human story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You're just sort of like, and I think that's sort of the thing about space too, and the thing about your humor in general is that you know, you're gonna humanize these environments that you know are really kind of sterile in a way, or yeah. over the top,
and in a dramatic way. You know, that's what the best sci-fi has done. I think he's gonna kill me if he didn't, but one of my co-writers, Brandon Braga, I can't remember if this was his episode or not, wrote an episode of Star Trek where there were two characters beaming up at the same time.
Yeah.
And they accidentally got merged into one guy.
Oh, yeah.
Completely fictitious, absurd premise. But it was presented as in this very human kind of civil rights sort of way, because the guy was now saying, hey, I want to stay this guy. I don't want to be these other two guys. I want to be this guy. And they're saying, well, if these two guys still existed, they would probably want to be themselves. So do we make this decision for you? Do we force you back into two guys, or do we let you stay one guy? And so it's ridiculous. But it was so like
philosophical conversation,
and it was presented as real. So that's a lot of what I do does. I am fascinated by the impossible, the fictitious, the absurd presented in a very accessible, normal way. Yeah.
Yeah, in that first episode when the blue guy's eyes blow up for no reason, just squirts blue. It's not explained or anything, but it's a reaction. It's just was he afraid or what?
I think that's the, you know, we keep that vague. It's network television. You'd have to ask Rob Lowe.
So now you're safely flying around in space and doing swing music.
that's what's happening.
Have you gotten all the fuck you out of your system?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. As I said, like I'm enjoying myself more than I have at any point in my career with the Orville, probably because, as I said, it's so hard to write jokes, and you know, when you're doing an hour long show that's kind of focuses on story and character, you just can, you know, you don't have to worry about ending a scene with a gag. You can end a scene with a thought.
Right.
And it's like, you know, being at boot camp for years and suddenly being stationed, you know, someplace tropical.
But, and now do you feel like Family Guy's behind you?
I don't, you know, the idea of doing a Family Guy movie is still very much in my head. I think that's still, that's still a possibility.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, that would be a challenge at this point, because to go back in and it'd be a fun challenge to figure out how that franchise translates for me after having been away for so long. You know, if I came back, would I write it the same way? And I don't know. It's interesting to, I look forward to exploring it at some point.
Right. So you're willing to try.
Yeah.
And so your mom's passed, but your dad's around.
He's around. Yeah.
And he's out here.
He's out here.
So you see him a lot.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. He shows up at my house sometimes when I don't even know he's there.
Yeah. You guys get along good?
Yeah. No, he's great. He's great.
Well, that's good. So now, from what I understand, you seem to be have been stricken from the books at Kent.
You know, I don't know, because I haven't looked into it in a while. I think there was a third party attempt to reach out recently, but it was kind of an odd
to reconcile.
Yeah, I think so. And it was I gotta dig it up, because I don't.
What was the approach?
It was just, hey, you know, there's a desire to make amends and
really
bury the hatchet and
over the Griffin thing.
Yeah, over the. I mean, mainly over the headmaster parents television council thing. Yeah. I just didn't know what to make of it because I didn't know who
what they wanted from
me. I didn't recognize the name and yeah. know who it was from. So, but I think there's absolutely room for that to be patched up. I do only because when I go back to visit my hometown, I kind of like to, you know, I am a very nostalgic person, and it's nice to kind of walk around campus and you know, see where you once spent so much of your time. And, you know, I it's like going to visit your childhood home. It's just, it's a nice thing to be able to do.
Is your childhood home still there?
It is. Yeah.
And do you still, like, at some point when I'd go back to Albuquerque where I grew up and I drive by the first house, at some point it stopped doing the thing.
Oh, really?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just like I have memories of it, but it becomes...
It becomes very distant.
A little bit.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. And the second house I lived in, it's no longer there. So that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And the city changes around it. And I don't know what I'm looking for, but there is, when you do go back, it's just, even just the sky or a tree, it's sort of like it takes you to something.
Yeah, and it smells. It's like, you know, you walk into the old bookstore and oh my God, it's but this is a town that doesn't, it's changed, but it hasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
So a lot of that's still.
And do people see you walking down the street and they go like, Seth?
No, it's a small enough town that, and also, you know, I don't have that kind of, contrary to popular belief, I don't have that kind of
visibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can
disappear.
Yeah. I can walk around Manhattan and nobody gives a shit.
it's a gift.
It's nice. They don't care.
Yeah, it is good. All right, buddy. Well, I think this was good. You feel good?
Yeah, all good.
Thanks, man.
Cool.
Seth MacFarlane, folks. I enjoyed that. I hope you did. New season, the second season of The Orville, is on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on Fox. Oh, my God. I'm going to play an echoey old blues riff for a couple minutes now.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.